One of my favorite stories is of the parents who were nervous because they were preparing their 16-year-old daughter for her very first date. They got even more nervous when they open up the front door and they see the date. He's on a motorcycle. He's wearing black leather. He's covered in tattoos. He's got piercings all over, and he looks like he's at least 29 years old. And the father politely closes the door for a moment, and he turns to his daughter and he says, "Honey, I'm kind of nervous about this date." And she said, "Daddy, why would you be nervous?" He said, "Well, I'm not sure your date is very nice." And she said, "Daddy, if he wasn't nice, would he be doing 1,500 hours of community service?" It is very hard to create a new future once you have been given a label. And people are good at giving labels. Even church people. In fact, I might say especially church people. That's one of the reasons that I've always been drawn to these unique parables in the Gospel of Luke. And today, we begin a new series that's going to take us quite some time to cover as we look at some of the stories that are only in the Gospel of Luke. I find them delightful, but I find them disturbing because these stories remind me better that I better not make quick judgments about people as to who is good or bad or ugly. Because these stories will always catch you off guard. They seem to always have surprise endings. In the Jewish world, there was no such thing as a good Samaritan. But that's not how Jesus told the story. You can't imagine how shocking it would be in their day to hear a story about a Pharisee and a publican going to a temple, and it's the publican that goes home justified. And Luke has filled his gospel with these amazing stories because he's writing to a church that is trying to embrace this new way of Jesus that has obliterated all of the old boundaries that so long have been used to categorize people. But now, in this new way of Jesus, there's no longer male nor female. There's no longer slave nor free. There's no longer Jew or Gentile. In this new way of Jesus, those old labels don't work anymore. And so Luke sends them all these amazing stories about people with labels that have surprise endings. Don't be so quick to know who's good or bad or ugly. The prodigal son that embarrassed and insulted his dad actually turned out to be good. And the boy who stayed home and took care of his dad actually turned out to be ugly. And these parables tell us to not be so sure how God looks at people, because God's vision transcends labels and categories. When Hamilton College was having their centennial celebration, they asked one of their most famous alumni, Alexander Wolcott, to come back and give a major address. And this is how he began his speech. "I send my greetings today to all my fellow alumni of Hamilton College scattered all over the world. And some of you are successes and some of you are failures. And only God knows which are which." And we're going to see today over and over in these stories as we go through this series. We're going to hear a story about a rich man that had linen for underwear, and that was unheard of in Jesus' day. And outside his gate, there was a man who had dogs that would come and lick the sores that were all over his bodies. But at the end of the story, the rich man is in hell, and the beggar is at Abraham's bosom. So who was the success? Who was the failure? We will see this over and over. But our first story is actually going to illustrate the truth with real character. So open your Bible up to Luke chapter 7. We will get to the parable in just a moment, but first we have to set up the context in which the parable was told. One of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him. So Jesus went to the Pharisee's house and reclined with him at the table. Now you should know that this is not a unique instance for Jesus. We know that he would eat with sinners and tax collectors, but he would eat with Pharisees as well. At least two other times in Luke's gospel he did this. Jesus was a preacher, and if you offered him a free meal, he showed up. He would eat with the rejected, and he would eat with the respected, because he knew what everybody needs to know and what this man didn't know yet. That every meal Jesus ever ate was dinner with a sinner. Now look at the text with me in Luke 7, beginning in verse 36. We read these words. Now one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him. So he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. When a woman who had lived a sinful life in that town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster jar of perfume, and as she stood behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. And when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." You have an incredible contrast here. Simon, the Pharisee, and this woman. And the story implies that somewhere in the past, this woman had this transforming encounter with Jesus. She had met him somewhere. She had somehow received the good news, and she had come to say, "Thank you." Later, you will see in verse 47 that Jesus says of her, "I tell you, her sins, and they are many, have been forgiven. She's shown me much love." You see, she was not coming to earn forgiveness. She was coming to thank Jesus for the forgiveness that had already been extended to her. She was coming to thank Jesus for loving a label. And here's what she thought. Grace is amazing. That grace could be extended to somebody like her. She wasn't just a category anymore to be disdained. And her gratitude was so deep that her emotions overwhelmed her composure. You see, she did not come to wash Jesus' feet. If she had, she would have brought a towel to dry them. She came to anoint Jesus' feet. But she got into the presence of a man who, for the first time in her life, didn't treat her like a label. And she couldn't hold in her emotions anymore. That word that is in this text for weeping is not the kind of crying that is sniffling. It is the kind of crying that is deep down in your gut that you just bend over. And she began to sob. And as she did, her tears were so big that they splattered on Jesus' feet. And now his feet are all wet. And she doesn't have a towel. So she's trying to make things better. And she's actually kind of making it worse, because in that culture, a woman never lets her hair down in public unless she's a loose woman. But she's got nothing else. She's so overwhelmed that all of her actions are in some ways more profound than any words she could speak. And so she's just crying and she's sobbing and she's taking her hair down and she's trying to clean up the mess that she's made. And she takes the only thing that she owns that is probably worth anything, and she takes that perfume and she starts to pour it on his feet, because that's what she came to do in the first place. And Jesus is moved. But he can barely enjoy the fragrance of the perfume or of her devotion because somebody in the room has a really stinky attitude. Have you ever noticed that every time Jesus went to a party, there was a pooper? And Simon is dismayed that this tramp would walk into his house, come into his party, but he's even more disturbed at the welcome she got from Jesus. And I tell you what he's thinking. He's thinking, this is disgraceful. He's just like Jonah in the Old Testament. He's just like the elder brother in Luke 15, and we'll talk about him later in this series. There are always people who think, we've got to help God, because if we don't, God is going to go out there and he's going to give grace to people who don't deserve it. And so Jonah says, God, I knew you would do this. You'd give grace to those Ninevites if somebody didn't try to stop you. And the elder brother says, what are you doing throwing a party for this punk son of yours? You see, someone's got to be on charge to guard God, because if you don't, God is going to go out there and give grace to people who aren't good enough. And that's what he's thinking. Simon believed in salvation by separation. And that view always demands labels. How am I going to know who to separate myself from unless I come up with the categories that I can put people in? And so, consistent with his view, he decides Jesus needs a label too. And the label he's ready to give him is not very holy. Because he thinks if Jesus was a prophet, he wouldn't have dinner with a sinner. But Jesus proves he's a prophet because he reads Simon's mind. And look what he says. Now comes our parable in Luke 7, beginning in verse 40. Jesus answered him, Simon, I have something to tell you. Tell me, teacher, he said. Two men owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. Neither of them had money to pay him back, so he canceled the debts of both. Now, which of them will love him more? Simon replied, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt canceled. You have judged correctly, Jesus said. And then Jesus asks the strangest question. Then he turned to the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who has been forgiven little loves little. Then Jesus said to her, your sins are forgiven. The other guests began to say among themselves, who is this? He even forgives sins. Jesus said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Did he see the woman? Simon never took his eyes off of her. See, Jesus does it again. He told a story with a surprise ending. He totally turned the tables on Simon. Simon thought he was in the position of judge, but he winds up being in the position of accused. And Jesus is basically saying to Simon, Simon, I do know what kind of woman she is, but I also know what kind of man you are. So why are you upset that I have dinner with a sinner? I'm having dinner with you. You see, this story has some profound implications for us this morning. And here's the first. Write this down. It is good news that Jesus forgives sinners. Now, some of us have come to church so long that we have forgotten that that is good news, that Jesus forgives sinners. He taught and he embodied a gospel that transcends labels. He said, "Do you see this woman?" He is not questioning Simon's vision. He's questioning Simon's heart. "What do you see when you see a woman like this, Simon?" Some years ago in his book, Who Switched the Price Tags, Tony Campolo tells a neat story. He was teaching this sociology class up in Pennsylvania, and his room that he was teaching in was full of students who were not Christians. And he thought to himself that he would have a discussion that could lead to showing the superiority of Christ. And so he starts class with this question: "What would the major world religions say about prostitution?" And they have this very lively discussion. And of course, where he is going is, what would Jesus say to a prostitute to show that Jesus is superior? So he finally says, after he sets them up, "What would Jesus say to a prostitute?" And he's got this student in his class who is Jewish. And he says, "Jesus never saw a prostitute." And Tony thinks, well, he just doesn't know his New Testament. So he flips out his New Testament and he says, "Oh, yes, he did." And the student doubles down. "No, Jesus never met a prostitute." So Campolo turns to a certain passage. He says, "I can show you right here. It says that he did." And the student got kind of angry and said, "Doctor, you're not listening to me. Do you think when he saw Mary Magdalene, he saw a prostitute? Do you think that's how he looked at women like her? Jesus never met a prostitute." Tony said it took someone who didn't even accept Jesus to teach him about Jesus. Jesus didn't see labels. Labels are the creation of the enemy. And he will use people, even church people, sometimes especially church people, to try and form an identity that Jesus wants to transform. I have had shirts that I'm particularly fond of in the past, and I have spilled stuff also on the shirt that I am fond of. And every time, if I'm worried about what got spilled on my shirt, my wife will say to me, "Don't worry about it, I can get that out." And she'll do her magic, and the stain will be completely gone. You can stare at that shirt that I'm wearing, and you won't be able to see where it was, but you know what? There have been a couple of shirts that this has happened to that even though you cannot see anything on it, I can still see it. And if I put it on, it's all I think about. So I never wore those shirts again. The enemy wants to haunt you with past stains. Because God will never haunt you with the memory of a sin that he has forgiven. And so if that memory comes back, where did it come from? You see, the good news is that Jesus liberates us from the shame of old names. And here's this woman. And she has been a label for years in that town. But now she is not ashamed to come to a place where everybody said, "You don't belong here." Why? Because she knew how Jesus saw her. That's why I love how Ephesians 1 verse 11 reads from the Message. The very first part of that verse says, "It is in Christ that we find out who we are and what we are living for." In Christ, we find out that we are forgiven and that we are invited to a dinner. It really is good news that Jesus forgives sinners. That's why I think, secondly, it is bad theology to place trust in my goodness instead of God's. That's what Simon had done. That's why he kept labels, because Simon's view of righteousness said, "Salvation is earned and paid for through good deeds and right living." It is a theology that is guaranteed to promote pride. Because you come up with ways to separate yourself from people who do not measure up. What it cannot produce is peace. You notice at the end of that story, Jesus gave that woman the one thing that Simon never had. Peace. And I know what I'm talking about because for years, I thought like Simon. I was Simon. According to my theology, you impress God by being more right than anybody else. Morality, doctrine, and I had labels for everybody. I was taught labels. This is what you call the people that aren't doing what they're supposed to do. This is what you call the people that don't go to the right church. We had labels for all kinds of people, and it filled me with pride. But one thing it never did was fill me with peace. Because what if there was somebody more righteous than me? Now, Jesus' theology does not say that all people sin equally. Notice the difference. Nor does it say that all sin has the same temporary consequence. That is not true. If I deceive my wife and cheat on my marriage, that does more collateral damage than if I deceive my wife and cheat on my diet. Jesus doesn't say that everybody sins the same amount, and Jesus doesn't say that it doesn't matter what the sin is, they all do the same damage. No. What he does say is that all of us have sinned, and none of us has the resource to pay our debt to God. How many sins does it take to send a person to hell? One. Do you realize that God could totally glorify his justice if he sent his wrath on all of us? But instead, he sends his mercy. He is the master who says, I don't care who sinned the most. I choose to cancel the debts of anyone who asks. So you've got these two theologies, and you've got to decide, which one are you going to bank your eternity on? And I like the story I've told several times of the lady upset with the photographer when she got her pictures back. She said, these pictures don't do me justice. And he said, lady, you don't need justice, you need mercy. Do you really think that when Jesus said, he that has been forgiven little loves little, he thinks that there are really people out there who have been forgiven only a little? I think he's speaking tongue in cheek, just like he did two chapters earlier when he said the healthy don't need a doctor. Is there anybody out there who's healthy? We have all been forgiven much. You know why? Because we've all sinned much. Can you go a day without sinning? An hour? I have been praying this prayer lately, and I want to share it with you. Dear God, so far today, I've done all right. I haven't gossiped. I haven't lost my temper. I haven't been greedy, grumpy, nasty, self-centered, or overindulgent even once. But in a few moments, God, I'm going to get out of bed, and I'm really going to need your help then. So why should we mind it if this church fills up with sinners? It already is. Every week, we come to dinner, we take some bread, we take some wine, and we remind ourselves, I've been forgiven. Not because I'm good, because God is. Look at verse 7 in Ephesians 1. In him, we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins in accordance with the riches of God's grace. Now, if you can't see the truth in yourself that I just read to you, you're going to constantly be offended at who it is that shows up to the table. But if you can, and if you know you really are, you know you should love much, and you know that he has love that has yet to be declared. And there is one more very important point in this story that I think could be missed. I believe that the story is saying to us that it is ugly when a high view of self produces a low view of praise. It was just common courtesy in that day when you have a dinner party that you wash the feet of your guest and you kiss him on the cheek. Why did not Simon extend that kind of common courtesy to Christ? Because he was so impressed with himself, he wasn't about to make that itinerant rabbi his equal. Let me tell you something about the self-righteous. They can fake a lot. They cannot fake passion for Christ. They cannot fake worship. They do not come to Christ extravagantly, but forgiven sinners can't come any other way. Do you notice how she magnificently compensates for everything Simon should have done? And what I think is particularly beautiful, do you notice that she takes the very things that she had been using to sin with? Her hands, her lips, her hair, her perfume. And now she uses them to worship. You see, I'm reminded when I read this of this verse in Romans 12. I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to present your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Is this too much to ask? You see, one of the things that we're going to find in all of these stories that Jesus tells us is this. He hardly ever wraps it up tidy at the end. He makes you wonder what happened next. How did Simon respond? Did he keep his bad theology? Did he hold on to an ugly heart? Or did he start to tear up and get down on his knees beside a fellow sinner at the feet of Jesus? I've known a lot of Simons. It's not hard to recognize them when you've been one yourself. I've known fewer people like this sinful woman. But you do not forget them when you meet them. I remember hearing a preacher that I love tell a story about his church down in Texas. It was a long time back. And in a worship service came this young man with long hair and tattoos and a motorcycle vest. And he had the arms cut out. His name was Billy Ben. You noticed him because back then his clothing was not typical for a Sunday morning church service. But you noticed him more because every time they sang songs of praise, Billy would lift his hands to the ceiling. And listen, back then in a Church of Christ, you just did not do that. And that bothered some people. Some of them even called the elders. And the elders were so cool about it. They said, listen, Billy's just excited because he got saved recently. He will calm down and be like the rest of us before long. But he never did calm down. You see, you need to know the backstory. Billy had struggled over 20 years with terrible drug addiction. And we say sometimes rather flippantly, Jesus rescued me. Billy knew what it meant to use the word rescue. He was rescued. You see, he wasn't doing it for show. He didn't even notice anyone was around. When it came time to sing about Jesus saving someone, he had to do that. His favorite song was On Bended Knee I Come. Billy never calmed down. In fact, it got contagious. And some people would come to church service early so they could sit in Billy's section. Billy had little education, and he lived in a house smaller than some of your garages. But he approached the preacher one time and said, "I want to memorize the book of Ecclesiastes and share it with the church." And the preacher's first thought was, "Billy, are you on drugs again?" Well, 1 month later, Billy came back to the preacher and he told him, "I've got it." And the next Sunday night, he stood up before the church dressed like Solomon, and he quoted the entire book of Ecclesiastes word for word, and he didn't make one mistake. So the next year, he did the book of James. The year after that, he quoted the book of 1 Peter. Billy, sadly, recently passed away. He didn't know that he was diabetic, so he went into a coma. All his years of drug use had took a toll on his body. And when Rick Astley preached his funeral, he said, "To this day, it was the largest crowd at a funeral he's ever had at his church." And during that service, they sang the song, "On Bended Knee I Come." And over 1,000 people held up their hands in tribute to Billy. Because Billy taught them that the gospel is for sinners. And forgiven sinners can only come to Jesus one way. Sold out, not caring what anybody else thinks. You see, I really want to know what happened to this woman. This story screams for a church for her to go to. What's going to happen when she leaves the party? She desperately needs a community of forgiven and forgiving sinners. And you know what? So do you. I hope we're that kind of church. I want to be that kind of church. I think you may be able to get a glimpse if we are or not by how we worship our rescuer, Jesus. I want you to stand up. I want to pray over you this morning.